Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzstraw. On today's show, cybersecurity. We're going to update you on what's been going on. North Korea is back in the news, not for good reasons, as the U.S. Potentially heads for war with the rogue nation. And of course, the ongoing Russia story about the election. And as we gear up for a 2018 midterm election in the United States, is our infrastructure ready? Are our elections at risk of tampering from foreign or domestic actors? And of course, there's been hacks involving private companies and money being stolen. So with all this stuff going on and all these news stories that you're being inundated with about cybersecurity, what should you think about it? How do you interpret these stories? Do they matter to you? Are these services you are using? And if you're talking to your representatives in Congress or at the state and local level about your concerns about hacking, how can we make sure that that's a positive conversation so the policymakers can make policies that actually help keep our data secure without stifling innovation or having otherwise adverse impacts? Joining me to discuss this topic, we have friend of the show, Heather West, Senior Policy Manager for the Americas at Mozilla. Heather, thanks for joining again.
Thanks for having me.
And back for his second episode is Tech Freedom Executive Director, Austin Carson. Austin, thanks for joining.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure. Both times. The second time.
Both times. It's been phenomenal. I've loved both times so
both
far.
Repeats.
Yeah. So Heather, let's start with the recent, relatively recent news items of WannaCry and Petya. And, you know, when the average person hears these terms, I mean, maybe they're not sure what the hell's going on, but what exactly happened in these attacks? Like, who was hacked and who's responsible and what are we doing about it?
So there's been a number of attacks using what are generally known as zero days or O days, depending on which camp you want to fall into. But what that essentially means is someone's using a hack that someone has 0 days to patch. And when that happens, what we saw out of WannaCry and what we saw out of Petya is unpatched systems being kind of held for ransom and taken over, and then mysteriously kind of fixed. By a security researcher who figured out what the dead man's switch was, for WannaCry and Petya and all of these other variants. The really interesting thing about these hacks is that they're based on some NSA software that they use for offensive missions. That was. Hacked from them or leaked or however, we don't really know.
So the National Security Agency, which ostensibly is engaging in cyber, actions on behalf of keeping Americans safe, they were hacked, right? So these vulnerabilities that they've been stockpiling to use for whatever purpose then got out there and then they were used against who?
Windows, the operating system. Essentially anyone who wasn't getting security updates, was vulnerable to this bug. But the interesting thing about this story is it also demonstrates that the NSA is not inviolable. The operating system was patched in the interim between this hack and the release of the WannaCry exploit. But there were still people who got hit, and that's in governments, in hospitals, in businesses. Unlicensed copies of Windows all were vulnerable because they don't get the security patches in the same way that maybe a consumer Windows machine does. And really, just it's one of those stories that can be sensationalized. It's a really interesting story, and I think it's mostly mitigated at this point. But it demonstrates that this is something that impacts all of us. Even so, it's not the end of the world. I think that there were some.
We're still here, right? We're doing the podcast.
We're doing okay for now. We'll move on to that North Korea thing next. And
in the doomsday portion of the podcast.
So I think that there's a lot of very interesting data points out of that story. And just to plug a little bit of the work that we've been doing and some of the really good work in Congress, because, that's what I do. WannaCry actually led to the introduction of something called the Patch Act, which helps the government and private industry collaborate to patch this kind of bug and exploit, especially when they know that it has been leaked for some reason.
Yeah, and I think Tech Freedom wrote positively about that bill as well.
Now, oh, yes.
It's interesting that you brought up this whole issue of the consumer updates versus the business updates, mm-hmm. because anyone who has the latest version of Windows or a Mac, they're constantly being told by their service provider that they need to update. And while it may be obnoxious, if there's one piece of advice that me as a non-expert can give on this podcast, it's update your software.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you might get screwed. But there are places that maybe updating is not so simple, right? It's easy to read a story like, oh, old people who have Windows XP got hit. And then we can laugh and be like, oh, these idiots, why are they using Windows XP, right? When you think about hospitals, you think about other very complicated institutions that run on complex systems, not consumer systems. Maybe it's not so simple. Is that part of the problem, Austin, that like, you know, a hospital's got to run all this stuff. They got to keep people alive. They've got a lot going on and they can't deal with having to update their system all the time in the way that Windows might want them to.
So there's a couple components to this. First of all, is that there are a lot of legacy medical devices and infrastructure control devices that rely on older operating systems because updating those systems requires massive upfront investment. I mean, you're talking billions of dollars to move to a different technology stack that will go with the most up-to-date Windows system. Second component of that is it's not even necessarily so much that people don't patch their, or people don't update their own systems, but oftentimes the patch cycle for the developer side is going to be slowed down. They're not going to necessarily know to update something. They're not necessarily going to do it quickly enough. And a lot of times, like we saw with Heartbleed, even after it's made known that this is a widespread, very impactful vulnerability, you'll look back a year later and it's still being exploited by bad actors. Because maybe it's a small business, to your earlier point about they don't have the time. I mean, you have, you know, startups are the engine driving our economy and driving all of our great innovative successes to a certain extent. And yet they don't really have the time and energy to do much, but continue moving forward and building their products. So that's not going to hit most of the ecosystem because you're going to have most of the major actors that consolidate more and more of the actual network effects updating their systems, moving rapidly. If you look at your Google Chrome browser, it's version 157.12 or something like that.
Yep.
You know, and I guess Mozilla Firefox, I'm sure, is also.
Oh, we just came out with Mozilla or Firefox 55.
Right.
And have, I mean, that brings up an interesting point, though. I think, Evan, you're completely right that the best thing a consumer can do is make sure you're updating and make sure. And a lot of times the system will let you auto update. So you don't even have to think about it. So I can't remember the last time my computer asked me for an update because I've just told it to update in the background and don't bother telling me about it unless you need to restart the computer.
Well, that's why I say, sometimes I say restart later because I'm doing something extremely important, like finishing an episode of a TV show or like downloading some video game. So obviously,
you know, legally purchase video game.
Yeah. Priorities, guys. All right. The software update can wait. My cybersecurity is not as important as me finishing this episode of an HBO show.
Well, and which also kind of circles back around to another interesting point, which is there's like a tiered system of how obvious or easy something is or how stupid any individual end user has to be to have something happen. You know, there's like the classic Nigerian 419 scams where it's horrible English and they're just trying to get your credit card information, like the lowest caliber social engineering, literally designed to weed out only the least able to not get scammed people, right? Yeah.
We just lost our listeners who were victims of that scam. They're very offended.
Listen, guys, call us if you need emotional, not monetary support, because we can't help you with that, but emotional support, we're here for you.
Yeah.
And then second of all, you've got like your spear phishing attacks. You've got your slightly more advanced social engineering. And those actually go, I mean, you'll see major companies and even government agencies oftentimes get taken by super sophisticated attacks designed to look like an email from a person that should be contacting you. Right. And then you get that. But what I hear all the time talking to almost anybody from the security research community is that if you're a target, right, if you're a target, there are so many angles and vectors of attack that it's just a matter of time until somebody compromises your system. So what you're ultimately doing is trying to run faster than the other guy behind you away from the bear.
Bring on the nerds.
Right. Here, here.
I think you have to sit back and say, all right, so I'm a target. It's not going to, you know, behoove me to try to defend myself. Let's bring in someone who really knows what they're doing. And I think you saw that on some of the campaigns, some of the DNC folks. They once you realize it's a problem, mm-hmm. you start hiring the people who know how to fix it.
And then the other people who actually know how to fix it.
Right.
Yeah, the second group of people you hire is the ones that do it after you hire the first team that doesn't do a good job.
And I do think, you know, that's the interesting thing. I know Representatives Hurd and Langevin went to DEF CON to essentially call on folks to go ahead and help the government. And I think that that's a really great message. Of course, the government is not always structurally in great shape to take on the expertise of nerds or the hackers who may or may not always be entirely inside of the gray area as opposed to,
Yeah, there's this whole issue of black hat and white hat, whether you're hacking for good or hacking for bad. But then there's a cultural issue, right? I mean, when you go to DEF CON, you're like, these are not government-looking people. Or these are not people in suits. Like, how do you get some nerd who might hate the government? Like, there's like this anarchy libertarian type streak in the community, right? Like, how do you get people like that to want to work for Congress, right? I mean, or to even trust the government, because there's a culture, and maybe it's through Hollywood or elsewhere, that hackers are bad, right? Hacking has a negative connotation. I had Katie Massouris on this show, who founded the Defense Department's first bug bounty program, to talk about that issue. But isn't that a major barrier here, just the distrust between the government and the hacking community?
Yeah, and somebody has to step out first, ultimately, right? Like, it's going to require... I mean, when I used to work for Chairman McCaul, I used to always tell...
And this is, is Chairman McCaul of the Homeland Security Committee, which is why Austin is on the show to talk about cybersecurity.
Right. I know a few things, a handful of things. So I used to always explain to them, to the rest of the Homeland Security Committee and to other people, other staffers and other members of Congress, that you have to keep in mind, not just the security researchers, like the people that are very deep, that are hanging out on, I mean, it's still IRC, I presume. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. This might be dating myself
here.
Well,
then there's pretty IRC, which is fact.
Yeah, pretty IRC, right? So, I mean, you've got these people that ultimately, I used to say, because it's easy to understand, they all have Snowden stickers on their laptops, right? Like, fundamentally, if you don't step out and be willing to eat a little bit of crow and say, like, look, I know as a representative of the government standing in front of you, you know, we have not always done the best job of in any way incentivizing you to trust us
and
in a reasonable
like,
way. Yeah, exactly. But it's like, you know, you have to, hey, I actually give a shit. I actually do value the information and opinions of those people. I actually do think that there is incredible value to be had, assuming that the government can humble itself to some extent and say, hey, bureaucrats, technocrats, generals, admirals, right? People that are currently running these security departments.
We don't have all the answers.
Right? Yeah. Like, be willing to understand that there is an ambiguous circumstance. There is highly technical information that you can't have boiled down into a slide deck that you can then look at as you normally would in like the services and just feel fine about it and have it be cut and dry, clear, SOP based.
So
right? We've
seen the president asking agency heads, to implement risk management measures, you know, commensurate with the risk and magnitude of the harm that would result from unauthorized access. Essentially, we're seeing the executive branch just tell a
bunch
of...
Sounds tautological.
Yeah, right? Just telling a bunch of agencies, like, get your shit together, right? Like, there's too many hacks, it's embarrassing, it's terrible, it's bad for national security, but it's easy to just make declarations and say whatever, and then you've got, pieces of legislation, but... You know, what should Americans think right now, Heather, about their own government's security? Like, should they be skeptical? Should they be happy with the measures that are going on? Is this having an effect? Is the president's being out there on cybersecurity getting agencies to have better practices?
I haven't seen a lot of changes yet, but the government moves slowly. I think that that's to your previous point about how hard it is to get nerds into government. Nerds like to move fast and break things.
Yep.
That is not the way the U.S. government works, nor should it. I don't want to move fast and break the Social Security Administration and leave people without benefits. I do think that part of this is going to be very cultural, and bringing in the nerds is going to be important and require compromises on all ends. I know when the U.S. Digital Service was started, they kind of negotiated that they didn't have to wear suits. And that's one of those like really base cultural things. In D.C., you wear suits unless you're part of a tech company, which is why I stay in tech.
Evan is currently wearing a white V-neck T-shirt. So I'm going to point that out.
Says the guy in the Hawaiian shirt.
It's good to paint a picture for our listeners.
Exactly. Someone was telling me I needed a lapel pin the other day, and I'm like, I don't have lapels. I don't own a suit.
Yeah, what is that?
Yeah. Yes. But that's a very different attitude than the government has. The government you know, functions on rules and process and really wants to kind of sit there and say, like, here's the way we do things. And here are the salary bands we have. And they just don't match Silicon Valley.
No. And President Obama is trying to be like, hey, man, be a patriot. Right. Like, you know, back when he was still president, he was like, do it for your country. Don't do it for the money.
And a lot of people did.
Right.
And some of them are still there. Which is fantastic.
Good on you guys. Yeah. Stay put, please. Yeah. For everyone's sake.
Yes. But they're the people who are going to be able to step in from this agency by agency review and kind of say, you know, really, here's where your openings are. Because when you talk to the folks at DEF CON, the people whose job it is to kind of red team a system, and red teaming basically means taking on, you know, the role of an attacker and seeing how you can get into your own systems. And if you red team the government, you come out with a lot, which is one of the reasons that what Katie is doing around the kind of hack the Pentagon and that kind of thing is really important.
Yeah, let's see how vulnerable we are as the government.
Mm-hmm. And then we know how to fix it, or at least part of it. We'll never find all of it. But I'm skeptical that the U.S. government knows what it's doing right now. But what that means, again, is that we all need to kind of pitch in a little bit and help.
To the extent that the public can play a valuable role in maybe applying pressure to their government or saying, in addition to healthcare, in addition to jobs, we do care about these things. Are there bills out there right now that you think would have a positive effect? I mean, you talked about the Patch Act.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Internet of Things Cybersecurity Improvement Act of 2017 to try to put industry-wide practices for things that are then sold to the government. I mean, is this a good sign that, you know, Congress cares about the issue? They're trying to get their own house in order?
Yeah, I think briefly speak to both the Patch Act and Senator Gardner and Senator Warner's bill, IoT's Advancement Act?
Improvement.
God. Yeah. Whatever one of those nice positive words is.
Positive, yes. IoT plus, better, warmer, nicer. But in all seriousness, both of those bills, I think, are a very, in both the way that they're crafted and the language used and in the clear thoughtfulness and what I understand in terms of the background conversations, the people that were consulted along the way, it does show a legitimate change in the way that staffers are working with actual practitioners for the sake of understanding what the impacts of these are going to be from a technical and practitioner standpoint. So it's not like we're just putting out a bill that says, hey, secure the whole system, please. You know, like, let's not get, as you
that
said
would
last
be an
time,
unfunded mandate,
let's not
believe,
get cybered anymore.
Yeah. the Never Get Cybered Anymore Ever Again Act of 2017.
Awesome.
Right.
And we're going to assume that the NSA is acting on behalf of keeping us safe, right? That's their mission, right? Mm-hmm. And they've got this vulnerability and they say this could come in handy when, you know, to maybe use against a bad foreign actor or something like that. Are they asking the question, but wait, if this were to get out, could someone use this currently individualized vulnerability to then hack the world, right?
Hack the world.
And I think we had a podcast, Heather, where we talked about the vulnerabilities equities process, essentially how the government weighs the equities of essentially saying it's useful to have this vulnerability because we might be able to use it for X, but is it so dangerous that we have it and we're not telling people so that they can fix it? Is that creating more danger than the benefit we get?
Right. And that process, it is really important that folks like the NSA and DHS and all of these agencies that are involved in the vulnerabilities equities process are taking that kind of, you know, they're balancing those two interests. Is it safer to use it in an operational sense, but then maybe it gets out and something like WannaCry happens and it's so easily scalable that it impacts like this huge swath of the globe? Or is it better for everyone to just go ahead and proactively patch it? And that's where folks like the NSA, folks like Commerce, folks like DHS should be working with companies like Mozilla and all of these other software maintainers to really get things fixed. And that's one of those interesting pieces because that helps protect everyone. It's almost a herd immunity because the companies that are maintaining my browser and my operating system and my phone and all of the software that's involved with that, those are the same companies that the government uses. And if I, as a consumer, don't really have the ability to protect myself from something like WannaCry, and I, you know, if someone came to me and said, hey, you're using Windows and there's this flaw in it that's going to allow someone to take over your computer and demand a ransom, I'm not really going to know how to fix that. That's one of those places that we're all going to kind of count on these companies and these maintainers and the software libraries to protect us. As a consumer, you know, I need to be able to trust that they're doing their best and the government's doing their best to really figure out what the best outcome is at a very broad level and balancing all of those equities.
And so there's a really important to me, at least bookmark to this, which is it is hard work to model out what the threat's going to be, like to model out realistically how likely something is to get exploited, how likely something is to be able to be, you know, run some type of mass scanner of what configurations people are running and then automate an attack, right?
Essentially risk assessment.
Right, yeah. Right. Risk assessment. So this is the reason cyber insurance is so hard to some extent because it's all long tail, but there is definitely some hard work that needs to be done to work this out, because what is happening that is the opposite of what we need to do is that people are looking at all the ransomware attacks, which is where somebody's entire disk gets encrypted with strong encryption, the same thing that allows all of our stuff to be protected from these hackers and from prying eyes, whatever. And they're saying instead we want to break encryption so that we can decrypt these hard drives, whereas it makes what obviously we've talked about this at great length, done a lot of events on this. Heather's done a hell of a lot herself. Probably way more than I have, if we're being fair.
I'm not sure that's true.
I don't know.
It's not a contest, guys.
Right. We've been running together as a three-legged yes. race, and it's been wonderful.
Exactly. On your skateboard.
Right. On the skateboard.
I don't know how the skateboard fits in, but you always have it.
You can drag me around. But the real takeaway from this is we're like literally the government is so unwilling to try to figure out what that risk model looks like and trying to work with it. And maybe this is unfair kind of, but it seems like they're less willing to try to figure out how to work in a logical way to mitigate these attacks and head them off and try to make sure the patch cycle operates properly, that they want to break encryption for everything and put everything at greater risk, increase attack surface for everybody. Then have that hard conversation, but which to me is like crazy.
So we've seen some countries though take a different approach, right? I mean, Germany, given the population and the politics there, something like breaking encryption is untenable. Mm-hmm. But they have been moving towards. Maybe it is tenable.
I'm shaking my head at Evan.
I'm getting some eyes from Heather. I mean, well, it hasn't happened yet, right? But obviously,
there's a lot of folks actually in Europe, I think Germany included, although I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, who have proposed these backdoors. And it is because they've made, you know, their job is investigations or intelligence gathering, and they've, you know, from that perspective, they look at this and they say, oh, I can keep you safer if you don't have encryption, which of course every security techie's reaction to is very visceral, because that's just not the way we understand the world to work.
But let's assume, you know, for the sake of argument, because in the United States so far we haven't broken encryption with legislation. We've seen legislation to do that. We've seen many countries proposing all sorts of things, but you know, for now, when you look around the world, encryption is still, you know, widely available, widespread. If government kind of gives up on that route, are we going to see government hacking, right? Because I'm kind of trying to leave the listeners with, you know, some, you know, kind of instructions on what to look out for. Right. You know, when you're consuming this cyber news and you're looking, you see this hack, you see this happening, you know, maybe you're looking out for stories of the government hiring experts. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're tracking the Patch Act and the IoT Improvement Act.
Or, if you are, call us. We'd love to have you an adjunct fellow. Yeah, or like you're really dedicated.
Yeah, yes. Or exactly. Or maybe you're looking out to see hacking, right? Is the government talking about doing more hacking? And is that dangerous, or is that a better alternative to breaking encryption, right? I mean, does the government
definitely the latter.
Yeah, does the government essentially need to be able to hack if they can't get into every device with a backdoor? Mm-hmm.
I think that people kind of talk about government hacking. You know, I would prefer that they didn't hack me, just full stop.
Well, that's a very controversial view for you to take.
I know, right?
But the reality. I also prefer to never pay taxes.
Yeah, that'd be cool too. But I want the roads to stick around. I like the roads.
Right.
Yeah. Who will build them?
Anyway, I think that there's a, you know, asking whether or not government hacking is an acceptable tool is a little bit, for me, the wrong question. The question is, okay, so you have this tool. And like a lockpick or a search of someone's home or, you know, breaking into their Gmail account or, you know, some other thing. This, you know, if the government is using these hacking techniques, they need to be using them within a responsible framework that's probably pretty similar to their other kind of law enforcement and intelligence tools. You know, you have checks and balances. You have a process that you go through to determine whether the target is the appropriate one. You have some discussion about what the correct scale is. And all of that's going to come up with other kind of surveillance debates in the next year or two as well. But I'm not sure encryption backdoors and government hacking is so far removed from that discussion. I think that that's part of the discussion.
Yeah, I think that they're part and parcel. And there's a great Kevin Bankston from OTI wrote a great 3,000 word piece in Lawfare. If you really want to read all of the things that the government can do to compensate for the not having access to literally every piece of information that exists in the world of encryption. Yeah.
Apparently that's a major problem, that the government doesn't just have everything on like a Dark Knight Batman style system. And we're talking about how we can do other things besides that.
Right. Yeah. Well, in fairness, like I do understand. Like, I spend a lot of time talking to people in state and local law enforcement, right? Whenever I work for the chairman. And you find that, you know, even people that work at forensic centers, they start out deeply frustrated because they have 12 terabytes that they need to lock away the sickest guy that they've ever found, right? Right. And legitimately, these people spend all of their days living and breathing things that are unthinkable to most of us.
Yeah, terrible things.
Right, to try to keep people safe in their communities. So in addition to that, even if they're at the forensic center, they don't have the broad suite of hacking capabilities that the NSA has or even other government agencies have. And so you've got this middle ground where it's not like we're going to extrapolate those capabilities all the way down the line to all of law enforcement. And at the same time, law enforcement is going to have to figure out at a state and local level, like how they interface with the FBI or the National Counterterrorism Center or whoever, the fusion centers, to be able to pull off these like information extraction. So it is, I get the frustration. I get the frustration with the inability to get information they would have been able to obtain in the past. But I think that the best thing we can possibly do, both from civil society and technical practitioner side and the government side, is try to accept objective reality that the state of technology is not going to regress. I mean, unless, again, the North Korea war thing we started with. Thanks, Evan.
Just trying to keep everyone safe, Austin.
Thank you.
So, if you have final thoughts.
No, I think... I think that there's a lot of resources. Instead of saying I have 12 terabytes to break into to put and lock this guy up, that's not the only tool at law enforcement's disposal. I think there's, when we had this spate of kind of encryption on mobile devices in the courts, my favorite case, not very many of them get to the point where they make or break is on this phone. In fact, I'm not sure I've heard of one recently. My favorite one was one out of New York, which the FBI also wanted to compel Apple to break into the suspect's phone. And when the judge told the FBI no, the FBI said, I wonder what other resources we have. They went and they talked to this.
Wait, they didn't just immediately give up on the case?
I know. I'm glad they didn't. But this isn't the only tool at their disposal. They went and talked to the suspect's spouse and were able to guess his password. Right. So they got into the device. They didn't have to break in.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5
Wait, that's my password.
I didn't think
anyone
else would
use it. Luggage combination.
Yeah. So no, that's a great point. And just, you know, getting back to the conference and to close out the show, you know, we recently had our Back to the Future of Policy conference, and one of the panels was on this topic of digital security, right? We're in an age where our lives are increasingly becoming digital, including the lives of law enforcement. And and how do they get the tools that they need, the information they need to keep us safe without stifling technology, breaking technology? I thought there was a really poignant remark by Harley Geiger, one of our panelists from Rapid 7, who just said, you know, the first step to having better cybersecurity policy is to stop demonizing each other. I mean, what did he mean by that, Austin?
I mean, I hate to say this because I feel like we were just kind of joking around about it, but ultimately to understand, I mean, to really try to have a bit of empathy, right? For people that spend all of their days in front of a monitor trying to code stuff, to understand that there are people who have for the last 40 years been burning shoe leather trying to lock up people that screw with kids, right? Yeah. Or that like murder people or whatever it may be, right? Yeah. And that's their day-to-day lives. And for people that are in law enforcement or in the government, whether it's from policymaking or from actual like operations, that folks that are spending all of their time trying to code, trying to poke holes in code, aren't bad guys. There are no monoliths, right? Every single person wakes up and goes to sleep and dreams just like we all do. And we should probably think about, I mean, except for Evan.
Yeah, I don't really dream.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Electric sheep.
Yeah, electric sheep. But fundamentally, like, we have to have a little bit of mutual respect. And I think if we can't start and say, where is our commonality, and how can we accept the information coming in, and how can we find, and if it's not going to be everybody, right? But there are going to be people who can bridge those gaps, and it has to be kind of a pyramid scheme. I mean, that's how it's always worked for me when I was on the Hill. I would meet two people who would have deep substantive knowledge, who would be able to connect me into like the B-Sides community, which dovetails with RSA and with Black Hat and all these other conferences, which is security researchers. And then you enter into this kind of cone of trust. Well, they'll actually try to talk to you, and then they'll help you with legislation. And then you can introduce them to other people. And bridging those gaps, I think, is honestly slow, it's difficult work, but it's the most important thing that I think we could possibly do. Because I, as a non-practitioner, as somebody who can hack together some HTML that kind of stinks and have somebody pay me too much for it, I don't have any idea what those guys are seeing on a day-to-day basis. Right.
I think that captures it really nicely. A lot of people think about this space as very adversarial, and it's the dude in his mom's basement hacking in a black hoodie. 400-pound
guy.
400-pound guy, that's what I hear. And the reality is when, you know, you have U.S. government officials going to DEF CON, these security conferences, they're really very, bridging that divide and moving from an adversarial approach to securing these systems and the government and all of the myriad parts of the ecosystem and moving it towards something cooperative, then we're all going to win.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if the listeners are freaking out, don't, because we just solved everything in this conversation. I mean,
empathy.
I think in one conversation, one episode, we solved the North Korea crisis. We saved our elections from tampering and we fixed everything. So, I mean, now you can just feel that comfort and just, you know, don't bother with the software update. We got you covered. Just kidding. Please update your software. That was a joke. Well, anyway, my guests have been Austin Carson, Executive Director at Tech Freedom, and Heather West, Senior Policy Manager for the Americas at Mozilla. Guys, thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll link to the blog post we've done on these cyber bills, and we'll link to some of Heather's excellent work, and you can check out her work for Mozilla. That's it for today. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Please don't fish us. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because it will help us find the show, others find the show, rather, and seriously, don't hack us.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.